Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
Kevin was a very helpful person that would give the shirt off his back even if it was his last one. You know, he didn't have a lot of means monetary-wise, but if you needed him for something, he would have been there.
He wasn't the long hair off just parting. We know this. We know something bad has happened. We just want answers. Kevin is a good guy. He didn't deserve whatever happened. He was a very good guy. He would not call his family. I mean, if it never went longer than like 2-3 days without any of us hearing from him. So it's just very non-typical of him.
Kevin would have never left my mom. He lived with my mom. And he would have never lost contact with the family.
...25-year-old Kevin Mahoney disappeared from Fargo, North Dakota in October of 1993. He had been at a friend's house helping out with some home repairs. Kevin supposedly left with the intention of walking to his brother's apartment in Moorhead, Minnesota, which is just a few miles away. The walk should have taken him about an hour, and no one ever came forward to say that they had seen Kevin that night. Kevin's brother was out of town at the time, so no one knows if he ever even made it there. Many people wonder if Kevin ever left his friend's house that night. For many years, not much was done with Kevin's case because law enforcement assumed that he had just walked away. But in recent years, they took another look at the case and even did some digging in the basement of a home in Fargo. What happened to Kevin Mahoney in October of 1993? The Fargo Police Department and Kevin's family both believe it was foul play. I'm Marissa, and this is episode 90 of The Vanished, the Kevin Mahoney story. Everyone knows that finding the perfect t-shirt can be a challenge. I've always had problems whether it was with the fit or quality. Luckily, the perfect t-shirt does exist, and you can find it at Skims. From cropped silhouettes to long-sleeve layering tees, there's a style for everyone. You know that I've been wearing Skims for a long time, and recently tried one of their t-shirts. It's the best-fitting tee I've ever worn. Skims makes the best basics and foundations. I got the boyfriend t-shirt in Onyx, and it's so soft and comfortable. I want to wear it every day. It literally fits like a dream. Shop the Skims t-shirt shop at skims.com, now available in sizes extra, extra small to 4X. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know I sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey, and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows. Michelle, who's one of Kevin's sisters, contacted me back in February asking if I'd be willing to cover his case on the show. I looked him up online and there was hardly any information about Kevin on the internet. I wondered how I'd be able to make this into a full episode. So I decided to put in a request for his missing persons file with the Fargo Police Department. I sent it out, made a little wish, and hoped for the best. The Fargo Police Department was very nice to deal with, and they quickly granted my request. All of a sudden, I went from having a few short paragraphs of information about Kevin that can be found on the internet to having a bunch of leads that the Fargo Police Department received over the past 24 years. Not only do I have Kevin's file, but I also spoke with two of his sisters, Michelle and Kim. Kevin's sisters warned me that the portions of Kevin's file that they had seen were full of discrepancies. Some of these discrepancies just look like clerical errors. For example, names spelled incorrectly or a sibling referred to as a friend and other times referred to as a cousin. What really bothered me the most about the inconsistencies were the differences in dates. You'll notice this if you do a simple internet search of Kevin's name. Sometimes the date of his disappearance is listed as the first, and other times it's listed as the second. While going through witness statements, it's impossible to tell all these years later if different stories were given to the police or if they're just clerical errors. I'm going to attempt to tell you this story without making it too confusing. But just know that stories and dates do change. For those of you who like to take notes, this episode is for you. The important dates to remember are Thursday, September 30th, Friday, October 1st, and Saturday, October 2nd. Kevin was the second oldest of seven siblings and was reportedly very close to his family. Leading up to Kevin's disappearance, he had been living with his mom, but he'd also been spending a lot of time at his friend Ben's house. He was helping Ben with a bunch of home repairs. Ben had recently gotten divorced and couldn't afford his home on a single income, so he was trying to fix it up to sell it. Ben's house had quite the reputation around town. Kevin's sister Kim told me more about this.
Ben's house was a party house. It was very well known. My brother, you know, was a 25 adult male. He liked to drink, and there were a lot of people that partied at that location.
Ben and Kevin would work on the house during the day and then start drinking later in the evening. So it was normal for Kevin to stay out late or end up crashing at Ben's. But what wasn't normal was for him to completely lose touch with his mom. When his family didn't hear from Kevin for a few days, they started calling around to his friends to see if they had seen him. When they didn't have any luck with that, they started calling hospitals, jails, and detox centers in the area. But again, no luck. So on October 7th, Kevin's sister Michelle went down to the police station to file a missing persons report. She supplied the Fargo Police Department with the information that she'd been able to gather from calling around and speaking to some of Kevin's friends. She'd been told that Kevin had left Ben's house in Fargo to walk to his brother's apartment in South Moorhead, Minnesota. I looked it up, and this would have been about a 3-mile walk and should have taken him approximately an hour. No one ever came forward to say that they had seen Kevin walking that 3-mile trip that night. Kevin's mom, Judy, passed away in 2014 without ever finding out what happened to her son. But we have her words preserved in the police report. She had last seen Kevin on Thursday, September 30th. Both Kevin and Ben were at her house that day. The two left to go to Ben's, and she never saw Kevin again. She told police that from time to time, Kevin would be gone for a few days with friends, but that they could always find him by calling around to those friends. It was unlike him to be gone for so many days without any contact. Kevin's older sister Kim told me the same thing when I spoke to her.
And I'm the oldest of seven. Kevin was the next oldest. And, you know, he felt it was his responsibility to look after my mom. He lived with my mom. And he kept in contact and let her know, you know, if he wasn't going to be home because he didn't want to get locked out. You know, she would wait up for him. And so this is just totally out of his nature to just disappear and nobody from the family hearing anything.
Kim lived out of state when Kevin went missing, but they had still remained close.
I was living in Washington State at the time, and right now I live in North Idaho, but Kevin would keep in contact with me. He would call me, collect. Like I said, our family was close, and, you know, every Sunday was a get-together at my mom's house, her Sunday dinners. When I would go back there every year in the summer, you know, we were doing family things. Kevin, he liked to fish, you know, he liked to hang out with the family. Kevin was somebody who could take care of himself, you know, if it came down to a struggle or something. So that's why I think his disappearance was out of his control. That's how I put it.
Kevin's family was very frustrated with how his case was handled for many years.
There's a point in the case, and I don't know how many years into it, where I think they finally realized there was foul play. In the beginning, the initial detective seemed very aloof and unconcerned because my brother was an adult. And I feel had he been from an influential family in the area, the case would have been handled differently. The person that owned the house had a brother, or has a brother, I don't know if he's, you know, they're both still alive, but that was connected with the police department in Bismarck, North Dakota. So this person that I'm going to call of interest has connections within the police department. For many years, when I'd contact that detective, the initial detective, and ask if there were any new developments, the reply I would get was, no, how about you? Well, I didn't live in the area at the time. I lived in Washington State. I'm not in law enforcement. I wasn't the one investigating, you know, such as he. So it wasn't a very cooperative arrangement the first couple of years, because he just thought my brother walked away. And Kevin would have never left my mom. He lived with my mom. And he would have never lost contact with the family.
The Fargo police did go speak with Kevin's friend Ben several days after Kevin's sister had reported him missing. They stopped by his house and spoke to both Ben and his roommate Daryl. They both stated that they'd seen Kevin on the afternoon of Thursday the 30th. They said that Ben and Kevin had gotten into an argument while fixing plaster on the house, and Kevin stormed off. They assumed that he was going to his brother's house, but they didn't pay any attention to which direction he was walking in. After that, the police department checked different homeless shelters, detox centers, and jails in the area for Kevin, leaving his picture in case he showed up in the future, but they never had any luck. A few weeks after Kevin disappeared, they went back to Ben's house to question him again. This time, he told them that he had last seen Kevin later in the evening on the 30th, and that when Kevin left, he was loaded. He didn't notice which way Kevin went when he left, but he claimed that Kevin made a statement about going to his brother's. He told them that he and Kevin had argued over a window. Apparently, Kevin had mismeasured the window, which led to the argument. He also told them that two of their friends had been there when Kevin walked off. Kevin's good friend Troy and Troy's girlfriend Lynette. Troy and Lynette were moving to St. Cloud, Minnesota, and had their truck parked there, packed and ready to move. When Ben woke up the next morning, Troy and Lynette were gone. He assumed they had already left for St. Cloud. They asked Ben if he would take a polygraph, and he agreed. Ben also gave them a tour of his house, and the detectives noted that they didn't see anything suspicious. During a third interview, Ben told a third and very different story. Now remember the other two stories, he said that he last saw Kevin on the 30th. This time, he said he last saw Kevin the following day on the 1st. The two of them had been drinking and were extremely intoxicated. Around 7 p.m. that evening, their friend Troy called and asked if they could come help load their truck since Troy and his girlfriend Lynette were moving to St. Cloud. He said the two of them went over to Troy's where they helped patch up some holes in the wall. Ben said he left their apartment alone that night under the assumption that the other friend Troy was going to take Kevin back to his mom's house. He said this was, in fact, the last time that he saw Kevin. If you're waiting for me to tell you that Ben was confronted about these conflicting stories, you're going to be disappointed. I can find no record of that in Kevin's file. He was given a polygraph, though. Now, we know that polygraphs are considered to be unreliable, which is why they're not admissible in court. They're still often used as an investigative tool. So I'll tell you about Ben's polygraph and let you come to your own conclusions. This polygraph was administered about 2 months after Kevin disappeared, and he was asked three relevant questions. The first question was, at this time, do you know where Kevin is at? His answer was no. The second question was, the last time you saw Kevin, was he okay? Ben answered yes. The third and final question was, did you have anything to do with the disappearance of Kevin? He answered no. The opinion of the examiner was that Ben was responding truthfully. In two of Ben's stories, he mentioned Kevin's friends, Troy and Lynette. The Fargo Police Department did track them down after they'd moved to Minnesota. First, they interviewed Troy's girlfriend, Lynette. She said that on Thursday the 30th, she and her boyfriend, Troy, stopped at Ben's house around 10 p.m. They stayed for a while before the four of them all went in Lynette's car to Troy and Lynette's apartment sometime after midnight, which would have then been October 1st. They were going to fix a door, but realized they didn't have the right paint color. She then drove Ben and Kevin back to Ben's house. She thought it must have been close to 1 a.m. at that time. After she dropped them off, she headed home and went to bed for the night. This is the last time that Lynette saw Kevin. She went to work on the morning of Friday the 1st and came home midday for lunch. She said that she saw Ben's car parked out in front of her apartment, which she thought was odd, but she didn't see him around anywhere. She then took lunch over to Troy before returning to work. That evening, she and Troy packed up their belongings in preparation for their move. They finished at around 11 or 11:30 p.m. and went over to Ben's house, where they stayed the night. She did notice that Kevin wasn't there, which she thought was odd, but she didn't ask where he was. The detective asked her how Kevin seemed the last time she saw him, which according to her was the early morning hours of the 1st. She said that he'd been drinking heavily and seemed bummed out that Troy was moving away. Kevin and Troy had been very close friends. She was also asked if Kevin had ever taken off before, and she said that he'd never been gone for more than a couple days at a time because he would get homesick very quickly. They interviewed Lynette's boyfriend, Troy, who had given essentially the same story that she had told them. Remember Ben mentioning the argument over the measurement of the window? They asked Troy if he knew anything about that, and he did. But he thought that the argument had happened several days before Kevin went missing. Troy suggested that the police department check Ben's credit card statement because he always paid with his credit card. They'd be able to see what the date was when he purchased the window. He also mentioned that Ben and Kevin often went out drinking, and Ben always paid with his credit card. Maybe they could track down their last movements with those credit card statements. I could find no record of Ben's credit card statements being tracked down in Kevin's file. Kim has also heard this story about the argument over the window. She spoke to someone who offered possible evidence of a struggle in Ben's home.
He was doing odd jobs. He was, you know, helping Ben remodel his house. Kevin also did inside painting. One of the stories was they had a discrepancy on the size of a window, and there was an argument that escalated. You know, there's just so many things. One of the things that I do remember was the realtor had somebody go in and redo the inside or whatever they did. There was a shape of a figure that had been like pushed into the sheetrock. And I think that was in the basement. And I had talked to the realtor or I had talked to the person that had done the renovation, and they remembered that, you know, that was in the house.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores. customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Ben had mentioned to Kevin's family that Kevin had called his brother before leaving that night.
He had said that Kevin had called one of my other brothers before he left. Well, that brother was out of town, and there was no way Kevin would have been able to reach him. It wasn't like the cell phones that people have nowadays.
I asked Kim if she knew if the police department had ever been able to verify that Kevin had called his brother that night. Maybe if they had, they'd be able to pin down the day and time of his disappearance a little better.
You know, that was one of the things why I was a little disappointed. I don't think that was ever followed up. Ben always paid with credit cards. They could have probably tracked the last couple of days of, you know, him and Kevin's places, maybe if they had purchased items for renovation or been to the local liquor store or, you know, one of the bars. I don't think any of that was done.
Ben told yet another story about the phone calls Kevin made before he disappeared. He said that Kevin had called several family members before walking away into the night. One of Kevin's friends, Lene, told Kevin's sister Michelle that she had spoken to him before he disappeared.
Ben also said that before he left, Kevin was calling everybody in his family, all the family members in his family, and I don't believe it showed that on the police records. We've never gotten to see the police records, but I really don't think that's the way it was. I know he did call Lene Olson that night and ask her for a ride, but she had to get to work, so she couldn't come pick him up, and that was the last person that I know of that have spoken to him about getting a ride.
Lene was a close friend of Kevin's, and about 3 weeks after he disappeared, she decided to go to Ben's house and check it out for herself. When she got there, the door was unlocked, so she went inside and started looking around. In one of the bedrooms, she found a pair of men's jeans that appeared to have a blood stain. She took the jeans down to the police department, where it was determined that it was, in fact, human blood. Back when this happened, we were in the early days of DNA testing, so they decided to hold on to those jeans with the hope of one day doing a DNA test on them.
Anyway, I asked them years and years ago if they had determined the blood type, and they had said no, they wanted to reserve or save it for if they did find a body that might have been Kevin's to match it. We don't have Kevin's DNA, however. My mom took a blood test, and Kevin's paternal grandfather was alive in Portland, and he actually went in and took a DNA test as well. So they could possibly someday match.
The only thing that I found in Kevin's file was a request that was put in back in 2007 to try to get a DNA profile from the genes to compare to DNA provided by Kevin's family. There's no mention of DNA results in his file, but his sisters hope that this is something that can be done in the near future.
You know, now that they have, you know, my mom's DNA and grandfather's DNA, and both have since passed away, so that would be a good avenue to pursue, I think.
These jeans were a size 34-34, and everyone believes that these jeans would have been way too big for Kevin. But Michelle told me that he would often borrow clothes.
Well, he wore baggy pants. He just wore whatever he could get a hold of to wear, you know, so he did wear baggy pants. if he stayed at a friend's house or something, he would, if he didn't have extra clothes or something, he'd just borrow a pair of jeans.
In 1994, Ben was questioned about the jeans, and he said that they didn't belong to him either. They were too big for him, too. He did mention that as he was getting ready to move out of his house, he gathered up clothes that some of his transient friends had left behind, and maybe that's where the jeans came from. One thing that's always bothered Kevin's family is that this close group of friends who used to hang out and party together, they used to just stop by their mom's house all the time. And after Kevin went missing, that just stopped.
Troy, you know, very familiar with my family, my mom, and, you know, would just stop by my mom's. And then after my brother disappeared, it's just like everybody went their own ways and never came around my family, never came, you know, around my mom. So I'm not quite sure. Who knows what? Kevin was a very helpful person that would give the shirt off his back, even if it was his last one. You know, he didn't have a lot of means monetary-wise, but if you needed him for something, he would have been there.
Not only did people stop coming around Kevin's family, but Michelle told me they also stopped associating with Ben.
What really bothers us is Ben's place was a main party home. Okay, all these people hung out there on a daily basis, on a nightly basis. And Ben was remodeling his home, and Kevin was helping him because Ben was going to sell the house back to his ex-wife. Well, as soon as Kevin disappeared, he trashed the house, and he gave it back to his ex-wife. And from that day forward, when Kevin disappeared, none of those people would come to his party and hang out with him, party with him, associate with him. It just, everybody just kind of had nothing to do with Ben or Ben's house anymore. And this was a main party house for, you know, at least a year or two, where people hung out every night. And it just seemed fishy that as soon as Kevin disappeared, nobody wanted to go there. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with Ben. Ben doesn't associate with any of the people that were around before. Last I know, he's been homeless for many, many years. He's got all different people he hangs around with. Nobody will even talk to this guy anymore.
Kevin's file is full of stories from people who came forward over the years, either saying that they'd seen Kevin or knew something about his disappearance. I'm sure that much of this is just simply rumors. And I believe that we can fit these statements into three categories. People who were trying to sound tough or cool while talking to friends or out at a bar. People in prison who were hoping for a lighter sentence for their own crimes. Or people who actually knew something. I'm not sure which of these categories each of the stories fall into myself. But I'm interested to hear what you guys think. Michelle told me about some of the horrific stories that she's been told over the years.
So, I mean, I've heard stories like he was shot up until he OD'd. I've heard he was cut up, put in a slough by Ponsford. He was in a slough down by DL and cut up, put in the walls in Benny's house. And then there was a farmhouse north of Fargo that somebody said they put him through a wood chipper. Yeah, I mean, just a bunch of horrific stories in that he had never walked out of that home on his own.
In December of 1993, a confidential informant came forward with a story about a man by the name of Lonnie. This informant told detectives that Lonnie said, "Paybacks are a bitch," and that they'll never find him, in reference to Kevin. This story goes back to a wedding that took place in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, back in July of 1992. Lonnie was part of a wedding party and was outside in the parking lot when Kevin and some other friends came driving through. Supposedly, words were exchanged and Kevin got out of the car and beat Lonnie up with a pair of nunchucks. There's no police report documenting this assault because Lonnie said he refused to go to the police, but he vowed to get revenge. The informant also mentioned that Lonnie had brought up someone by the name of Ben in relation to Kevin. The police went to Ben to see if he knew anything about this possible connection to Lonnie, and he said the name sounded familiar, but he didn't really remember him. Then detectives went to Troy and Lynette to see if they had heard of Lonnie, and they didn't know who he was either. Troy said that he thought it would have been really unlikely that Kevin would have beaten anyone up, and even more unlikely that he would have used a pair of nunchucks. Michelle told me that Kevin would sometimes get into fist fights when he was drinking, but nothing serious like this story.
Kevin, when he drank, he would get belligerent, as, you know, a lot of drunk people do. And even like my brothers, they'd get into fist fights when they're drinking. They just, who's tougher, who's more of a man, you know, that kind of attitude.
After Kim had a chance to go over Kevin's police file, she wrote me about this story and said that Kevin never used nunchucks or any other kind of weapons. She thinks this entire story is just nonsense. The police called up to Lonnie to inquire about this story. When they spoke to him over the phone, they noted that he sounded drunk and was very belligerent. He denied knowing what happened to Kevin, but stated he wouldn't care if something had happened to him. We'll probably never know if Lonnie had any knowledge of what happened to Kevin because he passed away in 2013. There was a possible sighting of Kevin at Rick's bar in November of 93. A woman came forward claiming that she'd seen him on November 18th, and she specifically remembered the date because she was there just 2 days after her birthday. She had gone there that night to see some friends who were playing at the bar. She felt awkward while she was there that night because she didn't know anyone. But then she spotted Kevin, who had been friends with one of her older brothers. She said he appeared to be there with another man in his late 20s or early 30s, and his hair appeared to be dyed dark brown or black, when he normally had blondish hair. He appeared to be intoxicated and continued to drink heavily over the next 45 minutes to an hour while she spoke with him. She didn't inquire about why he was missing because, at the time, she didn't realize he was missing. When detectives had stopped by Ben's apartment to inquire about the jeans with a bloodstain, they also asked what he thought about this sighting at Rick's bar. Ben had a friend with him at his apartment at the time, and both of them stated that they didn't think it was Kevin. The two of them told detectives that the people who frequent that bar look like Kevin. Tall, thin, long hair. They called them lost people. During this interview, Ben said that he still believed that Kevin had just wandered off and would show back up. In April of 94, Kevin's mom, Judy, called detectives to tell them about a conversation that she had at a bar with a woman by the name of Shirley. Shirley stated that she'd been at a party at Ben's house where they, and it doesn't specify exactly who they are, killed Kevin and then took him out and threw him away. When detectives tracked down Shirley to ask her about this story, she said that she had spoken to Judy, but only told her that she had heard of Kevin. They gave Judy's phone number to Shirley so that she could call her directly and discuss it with her. A couple months later, Judy called detectives again, asking them to please talk to Shirley one more time. Kevin's mom felt like Shirley knew exactly what happened to her son. Before she contacted police, Judy had been trying to contact Shirley, but she wouldn't take her calls. It looks like detectives did stop by Shirley's home one last time and left their card with Shirley's 12-year-old daughter. That appears to be the last attempt they made to contact her. In 1996, family members were out hanging flyers for Kevin when they were approached by a man who stated that Kevin had made a lot of enemies and upset a lot of people. He said that he believed that Kevin was buried out on the Ponsford Reservation lands. They were able to track this man down 2 years later when he was in jail. They asked him about what he said about Kevin. He claimed that he had known Kevin and said that he thought Kevin was no longer with us, but that he had no firsthand knowledge of his disappearance. In 1997, they tracked down Daryl, who was often referred to as Ben's roommate in the file. They questioned him and gave him a polygraph. He said that he usually would go to Ben's house after the bars closed and continue to party over there. That's where he met Kevin. He remembered Kevin well because he often gave him rides from Ben's house to his mom's. He said that Ben and Kevin would usually work until 8 or 9 p.m. and then start drinking. The last time that Daryl saw Kevin, he was at Ben's house with his girlfriend and had seen Kevin up on a ladder painting some trim. Ben told Daryl that he didn't feel well that night and didn't want to party. Daryl and his girlfriend decided to go hit the bars, but before they left, Kevin asked if Daryl could give him a ride the next day. Around noon the following day, Daryl went to Ben's to give Kevin that ride that he had promised, but Kevin wasn't there. Ben told Daryl that he and Kevin had argued the night before and Kevin left. Daryl passed his polygraph, but it's noted that Daryl's charts were fairly flat, not only on this polygraph, but also another polygraph from an unrelated case. This made it harder to score his charts, which decreases the accuracy of the exam.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. It's really frustrating when we look back at Kevin's case. There were some missed opportunities early on that I think could have really helped. For example, had they been able to verify the phone calls that Ben said Kevin made that night, or tried to track their movements leading up to Kevin's disappearance with Ben's credit card transactions. Kim told me why she feels his case was ignored in those early years.
And I think just because of his persona, you know, having long hair, you know, he liked to drink, he had gotten into some trouble with the law regarding alcohol. You know, I think because of all of that, his case was not taken seriously. And because Ben had a brother in the law enforcement, there's many theories our family has as to why this wasn't pursued as heavily as, you know, it probably could have been.
Even though the police had believed that Kevin walked away for many years, more recently, they've shifted their focus and publicly stated that they believe Kevin was a victim of foul play. I asked Kim if she knew what made them change their minds about Kevin's case.
I don't remember what year it was, but it was several years into the case. And there have been many detectives that have come and gone throughout this whole case in, you know, almost 25 years. I don't know what made them finally decide, oh, this is foul play. If it was the length or if they have something in the file, I honestly don't know.
Michelle told me she thinks the change happened after some cold case detectives took a look at his file.
They called in some cold case investigators, and they started taking a, these new people took a new look at the file. And that's how they came up with that. There was somebody that wasn't at the Fargo Police Department, I don't think. It was just extra people willing to work on this and have a new look at it. So I think that's when that made a change.
Fast forward to 2007. A tip came in, and it was more of a heard-from-a-friend-who-heard-from-a-friend kind of story. The story was that Kevin had been killed at Ben's house and put in a wall. A similar lead came in a few years later about Kevin being buried in the basement of Ben's house. When detectives approached Kevin's family with these stories, they recalled something that Lene had told them years earlier. Remember Lene was the one who found the jeans with a blood stain? She had also said that there was a patch of concrete in the basement that looked fresh and also didn't look very professional. Detectives decided to try and see if they could figure out when that particular patch of concrete was poured in the basement. First, they went to the house to look for this concrete themselves. They identified a patch that was 90 inches long and about 18 to 20 inches wide. Then they began contacting each person who had owned the home after Ben sold it just a month after Kevin disappeared. None of these people had remembered doing any concrete work in the basement. They brought Ben in for questioning once again, and he denied doing any concrete work in the basement. So then they went and tracked down the people who had sold the house to Ben. Those people stated that everything in the basement was original when they owned it, and they didn't do any concrete work. No one has admitted to putting down this concrete. In 2011, detectives decided to dig in the basement of Ben's former home. They brought in an anthropologist from North Dakota State University to help with the dig. They dug up the concrete in the area that they believed to be what Lene had mentioned years earlier. Now, the Fargo Police Department gave me 120 photos that they had taken during this dig, and I have them available for you guys to check out for yourselves at thevanishedpodcast.com. You can see that they excavated a small area and found a pipe underneath, and then stopped digging there. I know that Kevin's family wishes that the dig had been a bit more thorough in that area. When I look at the pictures, I can't help but wonder if you were going to bury someone, you may dig a little bit deeper than they did in this search. I'll let you guys look at the pictures and decide for yourselves. While they were at the house, the homeowner told them about a hole they found while they were doing some renovations. They had taken down sheetrock and insulation and found a 2-foot by 2-foot hole in the cinder block wall that led to a crawl space under a patio. This made them wonder about that story, the one about Kevin being buried in a wall. The crawl space area was full of sand, so they vacuumed the sand out, which just left the clay earth below. They had the anthropologist look at the area to see if he could find any disruptions that would indicate that someone was buried there. He came to the conclusion that the area under the patio had not been disturbed since the patio was built. He was also able to say, with 99% certainty, that there wasn't a body buried under the patio. Probably the most disturbing story that I read in Kevin's file came from a man, Scott, who came forward in 2009. A year earlier, he had a conversation with a friend, Phil. Phil said that he was living with a lot of demons. He had hepatitis C, and if his health began to fail, he wanted to send a letter to Kevin's family explaining what happened to him. He said that they were involved in a drug deal with the Mexican Mafia and ended up owing them money. The Mexican Mafia supposedly told Phil that they would kill him if he didn't kill Kevin, so he did what he had to do. He then said that he put Kevin's body in the same place that Gina North went. Now, I have to give you a little bit of background. Gina North is an 11-year-old girl who disappeared from Fargo in 1993. 2 years after she disappeared, her neighbor confessed to killing her and dumping her body in the river. Her remains have never been located. Her neighbor has since recanted his confession, but was convicted of her murder in 1999. So fast forward to 2008 when Phil's telling this story about Kevin being put in the same place as Gina North. His friend asked if Kevin was put in the river, and Phil stated that Gina North wasn't put in the river. She was put in the grinder at Federal Beef. Scott didn't put much stock into this story until several months later when it dawned on him that Phil had a friend who had worked in the rendering department at Federal Beef in 1993. Then, Scott began to piece together statements that had been made over the years alluding to the fact that Phil owed this friend who worked at Federal Beef. Also, the friend who had worked at Federal Beef had stated that Phil had committed murder. Detectives tracked down Phil in state prison and asked him if he knew what happened to Kevin. He replied, "If you think I had anything involved with that, you're barking up the wrong tree." He also said that they probably got his name from someone who was trying to trade information for a lighter sentence. He offered to take a polygraph if they wanted him to, and that appears to be where the investigation into that lead ended. So what happened to Kevin Mahoney in October of 1993? Did he ever leave Ben's house alive? One thing that I noticed while going over Kevin's file was, all of these stories that don't include Ben, they don't have any information about how Kevin would have ended up with these people. Take the story about Lonnie as an example. We have this backstory about Lonnie and Kevin getting into a fight over a year earlier, but no one ever said that Lonnie picked him up the night he disappeared, or ran into him somewhere like a bar. Or this story about Phil and Federal Beef. There's nothing tying Kevin to the Mexican Mafia or to Phil the night that he disappeared. On the other hand, many of the stories keep going back to Ben's house. Did his stories change because of the amount of drinking that had been going on at the time, and he just couldn't remember, or is there another reason? Not only did Ben's stories change, but they also didn't quite add up to the stories that his friends had told. They were, at times, similar, but not the same. And what about the sighting of Kevin at Rick's bar by someone who knew him? Do you think that was just mistaken identity, or could someone have come forward to purposely mislead the investigation? This is what Kim thinks happened to her brother.
You know, we all have theories and we all can be hopeful, but my theory is that my brother Kevin did not walk out of that residence alive. I feel very confident that Ben and other people know where my brother is or what happened to Kevin or, you know, why he disappeared or, you know, things of that nature. It was just odd how everybody seemed to disperse and after Kevin disappeared and nobody seemed to keep in contact with each other and Ben cleaned up his act and quit drinking and, you know, I would have never recognized him had I not known who he was when I had returned on one of my trips from before Kevin disappeared to after Kevin disappeared.
One thing that's always bothered Kevin's family was that when they would post his flyers, it seemed like someone was purposely taking them down.
Flyers we would put up, you know, I would go to the local convenience stores, gas stations, the neighborhood he disappeared from, bus station, liquor stores, the bars. And in the beginning, it was very odd that every time the flyers were put up, the flyers would come down pretty quickly. Not certain who or what the reasoning might have been, but to me, that was another red flag that somebody knew something.
Michelle told me about a phone call she received late one night from Ben and Kevin's friend Troy.
And even after he disappeared, you know, Ben and Troy called me one night. It was probably 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, and they were all drunk, and they'd be like, "What do you think we did? Cut him up, put him in our attic," and things like that, you know. It's just like, where do you guys come up with this, you know? But we've heard so many horrific stories.
Kim still lives out of state, but she tries to get back to Fargo as much as she can. When she does, she makes Kevin's case a priority.
I would go back every summer to visit my family. And after Kevin disappeared, I continued to go back every summer. I would put up flyers, visit the police department. One of the times when I was back there when Kevin was alive, he had me take him to that residence. And so I know, you know, that many people have been there. And then after my brother disappeared, like I said, he sold the house. Ben cleaned up his act. He wasn't drinking anymore. I would look him up for several years every time I would come back to let him know that we're still looking for Kevin.
Ben can be a difficult guy to track down these days. For a number of years, Ben has been homeless, and when Kevin's family has made an effort to track him down, they've had to search local shelters to locate him.
Me and my sister Kim, it's been a couple years since we did contact him, but we found him like at the Dorsey Day House, the homeless shelter, or through like Labor Ready is like the only way we can try and find him, you know.
Michelle and other family members who still live in the Fargo area continue to try to keep his name out there.
You know, my job doesn't allow me right now to travel as yearly as I like to. My sister Michelle has kept the vigil going on Kevin's anniversary date, October 2nd. Her and other family members, you know, out there, you know, holding signs and letting the public know that we are still looking because, you know, 10 years after Kevin had gone missing and I'm putting up flyers and people are, you know, bartenders are saying, oh, I didn't know he was still missing. So we just want to get the word out to the public that maybe if they saw anything, heard anything, the neighbors, you know, that just one thing might be the tip that can lead us to solving Kevin's disappearance.
After hearing all the different stories about Kevin's disappearance, I'm interested to hear what you guys think happened. Don't forget to check out the pictures of the basement dig at thevanishedpodcast.com. At the time of Kevin's disappearance, he was described as being between 5 foot 9 inches and 6 feet tall and weighed between 155 and 165 pounds. He had blue eyes and long brown hair past his shoulders. If you have any information about Kevin's disappearance, please contact the Fargo Police Department at 701-241-8281. That brings us to the end of episode 90. I'd like to thank Michelle and Kim for taking the time to speak with me for this episode, and also the Fargo Police Department for providing me with Kevin's file. Hopefully, someone will come forward with information to help move this case forward. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, I have a Facebook page and a group. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram as thevanishedpodcast. Join me next time for the story of a missing teen from Tennessee. Thanks for listening.
I just want to thank you for, you know, being able to possibly shed light on Kevin's case and getting this out to people, you know, after this many years, to where maybe somebody will come forward and say, oh yeah, you know, maybe I better tell something I know, or maybe this information is helpful and I didn't think it would be. So I do want to thank you for that, and I appreciate your time.
And it was very frustrating, you know, when we would try to call the police back in the day and stuff and try to get answers and whatever things looked at, they would be like, well, if you're going to get crabby with us or you don't have the patience, we just don't want to talk to you anymore. And we were like, well, of course we're going to be upset. Of course we want answers. You know, you have to understand how we're feeling. And they were just like, well, if you don't want to agree with or talk to us on our level way of talking, we just don't want to discuss things with you anymore. And it's just like, well, how do you expect us to feel? You know, we were frustrated because they just put off Ben like, oh, he's just no problem, you know, and Kevin is just out there partying. And we know that's not the case. So, I don't know, it's just, and even the later on detective said, the detective that did it at the first beginning, that they did not do their job thoroughly.
I think the most important thing is that, as I said earlier, Kevin was a family person. He was very connected with the family, with my mom. And he would have never walked away from my mom, nor the family, nor lost contact with the family. That is the biggest indicator to me that there was foul play. That was not of his nature. You know, with my siblings living in the same area, and you know, like I said, there were seven of us total. It's just highly unusual for that to happen, of, you know, losing contact with him.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart-Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all six episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.